Good morning. You're listening to KUNV 91.5, and this is Neon Eden. I'm your host, J. Patrick Kulikin, columnist for the Las Vegas Sun. My co-host, as always, Sun reporter Tovin Lepan. Today, we're previewing the legislature with our man in Carson City, David McGrath-Schwartz, Las Vegas Sun reporter based up in Carson. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Interesting issue has arisen. It seems to be a direct effect of the election and Democrats overpowering or solid victory with the help of Latinos, and that is driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants, specifically those who President Obama has deferred action on, the so-called Dreamers. Tell us about what's happening in Carson City on this issue.
Well, after the election, I was curious about how these folks would be treated by the state. They referred deferred action from the president, and some states had pushed back against that, notably Arizona and their very conservative governor out there. But after the election, given the tenor of the election and the politics of it, Nevada is going to recognize those Dream Act Light as sort of their colloquially known.
Not a good radio word, Dave.
Yeah. And they're going to recognize them and grant these folks driver's licenses, at least for now. Some more conservative lawmakers are saying, hold up, this is something that the legislature should address and look at. But I would say, given the demographics of the state and of the election and where the Republican Party recognizes that one of its weaknesses is, there seems to be pretty broad support for granting this narrow segment of the undocumented immigrant community driver's licenses right now.
And they will do it, but they will do it, and they will sort of ratify it, if you will, affirm it in the legislature?
The DMV is telling me that they don't think they need to. The document that the Department of Homeland Security is going to be issuing to these DACA students.
It confers legal status, and therefore they can get a license.
Right.
Right. No,
exactly.
Whoa. There
well,
is,
sorry.
It does not give them a legal status. It actually just prevents the government. I mean, it's a deferred deportation, so they wouldn't be deported for a period of 2 years, and they get a work permit and a Social Security number. But technically, they do not get a legal residency status.
Right. And Tovin's right that it's that work card, a photo ID issued by the Department of Homeland Security, which has been recognized in other cases, and that's the justification of the Sandoval administration is, hey, we're not pandering the same rules that we've used in the past. We've accepted this form of ID for other immigrants of various status in the U.S.
What about the broader issue of driver's licenses for all undocumented immigrants? I ask because it's almost certain that President Obama, at the start of his second term, once they clear up the fiscal austerity bomb, as I like to call it, not the fiscal cliff, the austerity bomb, once they deal with that issue, that he's going to offer a comprehensive immigration reform. All the people who are not here legally are going to find some pathway to legal status. Is there any momentum in the legislature for, and I believe this would require the legislature, some process for driver's licenses for everybody else, bearing in mind, I believe Utah has done this, right?
Yeah. Senator Mo Dennis, the Senate Majority Leader, Democrat from Las Vegas, sort of after this announcement, one-upped the Sandoval administration by saying, hey, how about driver's licenses or driver's cards for all undocumented immigrants? That one will obviously be a trickier position, and Republicans haven't been as enthusiastic to embrace that. The Assembly Republicans have pivoted and said, hey, if a photo ID is good for undocumented immigrant driver's licenses, how about we do a photo ID for all voters, which has obviously been a Republican sort of goal or conservative goal throughout the United States. So what we're seeing here is sort of this pandering to the Hispanic vote and each side trying to one-up each other. On the Republican side, you know, they still have some more conservative members. We have obviously have a large rural portion of the state, at least geographically, which has representatives, and you know, it's going to be interesting to see how the larger caucuses handle this issue and the changing demographics.
We want to ask you about the voter ID thing, but let me ask you first. I mean, and this is, I guess, more of an observation than the question, but isn't it kind of remarkable the movement on this issue, the speed at which it's moved in just 30 days? I mean, this is not an issue that anybody wanted to touch in the past.
The driver's licenses?
Right.
Yeah, it is remarkable. I remember I was in Southern California when Gray Davis was facing a recall, and sort of as a last-ditch effort to secure his spot, he granted, or he said he was going to grant, driver's licenses to illegal immigrants. And that sort of blew up in his face. A lot of people saw that as, you know, pandering, or a lot of Democrats didn't support that.
That was in California.
Contributed to his recall.
People's Republic of California, of all places.
I know, which, you know, Nevada loves to hate.
Right.
So in Nevada, it is remarkable that, you know, the Sandoval, a Republican administration facing re-election in 2014, has sort of embraced this, at least for, and again, let's remember, though, that, you know, we're talking a few thousand, maybe 20,000 undocumented immigrants who are going to fall under this umbrella for the driver's licenses. But the Democratic caucus as a whole is pretty largely embracing it.
Mm-hmm.
And let's talk about the voter ID. Secretary of State Ross Miller, after the election was over, suggested that maybe a voter ID law would be right for Nevada. In the form that they're talking about right now, what would this voter ID look like? What are we talking about here?
So he's saying it's not a voter ID because you don't have to carry anything to the poll. What it would be is basically a Facebook, except not in the, you know, cool kid internet way, like a book of faces.
You're showing how uncool you are, because Facebook is not the cool kid thing anymore.
It's one of those cool MySpace pages.
Yes, exactly.
I'm sorry, I have kids, so I'm not allowed to be cool. Basically, in the book that has everyone's signature and name and address in there, where you sign when you go to vote, would also be a picture. They'd pull the picture either from the DMV, or if you don't have a driver's license or a state-issued ID, they'd take a picture while you're there. Democrats have been relatively split, but I'm comfortable saying that the more progressive base is a little upset at Secretary of State Ross Miller, who's a Democrat,
what's the objection? Other than just, I guess when I saw Ross Miller voter ID, I thought, oh, what is he doing? That's something they do in Florida. But then you actually read the details of what he's doing, and it seems kind of reasonable. And if it would lead, if we would have fewer Republicans who thought that Acorn fixed the election, which, according to a recent poll, half of Republicans say that Acorn fixed the election, even though Acorn hasn't existed in 2 years. What's to object? What's their objection? They just don't like the whole...
I think part of it is the slippery slope argument that this is the beginning of a voter ID. Hey, if the state already has a picture and you're okay with getting your picture taken, why not just require the photo ID? And it is also...
kind of a weak argument. I mean, they've got your photo, the system's in place, that's the system.
It's also confirming these conspiracy theories that Democrats, or, you know, the undocumented immigrants are voting stealing elections.
He's giving credibility to the nutties who think that... that their elections are fixed because there's all these...
Right. One of the key arguments against it, and at least the cover argument right now, is the cost. You know, 10 to 20 million are a couple of numbers that I've seen, and it's like...
That is,
you know,
a lot.
If there's no problem, why try to solve it? And the secretary says, you know, that there's a perception problem.
And but I will say he didn't exactly do a stellar job rolling it out, did he?
Well, I mean he rolled it out to the RJ, so of course I'll say no.
And they're a perfect audience for that.
But he didn't
let people know, am I wrong about this? He didn't really seed the ground and sort of make people feel comfortable about what he was doing. And
yeah, I mean, to take people behind the curtain, I mean, if you're doing a rollout, especially on something that's potentially explosive,
it's so contentious.
Something like immigration or, undocumented.
Or acorn fixing
immigrants
elections.
Or acorn, you talk to the stakeholders, you talk to legislative leaders, you talk to activists on the ground, and you try to get buy-in at least, so they understand where you're coming from, and they can, if not provide you cover, not provide ammunition for reporters to sort of show the pushback.
Right. Okay.
And it doesn't seem like he did it, to answer your question.
Okay.
But we should note, right, one of the instances of fraud that they found here, right here in Las Vegas, the woman was just attempting to prove that the system didn't work and, in fact, got caught by the system, which did work the way it was supposed to.
Right. And
she had voted over in the Orange Curtain or in Orange County. And
right. And supposedly this woman was overheard saying, they didn't even check my signature. I can just go vote at my old polling place and no one will know. And I don't know, did the system work? Look, the Secretary of State, and nationally, people had this myth of the voter fraud. Just there's very, very little hard evidence, particularly of any type of coordinated effort to steal elections. And it would be very difficult to do. I mean, we're talking trying to mobilize tens of thousands of people or thousands of people or hundreds of people to try to influence an election. I mean, to pull something off, I don't know any institution that has that sort of capability to pull off a conspiracy like that.
Well, especially since the criminals would be presenting themselves at the scene of the crime like that.
Yes.
It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on. New speaker, Marilyn Kirkpatrick. You wrote an interesting profile of her. She has just kind of an amazing background for somebody who's now climbed to the heights of Nevada politics. Tell us a little bit about her.
Yeah, so at 14, she basically found herself at Child Haven, which is, for all intents and purposes, the
Clark County Orphanage,
home for neglected and abused children, and she found herself on her own. She emancipated herself from her parents at 16, one of the first people to do that in Clark County. It was pretty unheard of then, and finished high school, worked her way through high school, living on her own, and now finds herself in one of the most powerful positions in the state.
And how did that happen? It's quite a series of events. It just kind of anything can happen in politics.
It is.
She got elected in 05, right?
Right. She got elected in 05.
Or no, that's not election year. She got elected in
04.
04, okay.
Her first session was 05. Had a relatively quiet session, at least nothing high profile. 2007, she gets, or she volunteers, actually, to work on this green tax abatement bill, where basically she has to go up against all the casinos and powerful developers
who got all these huge
tax abatements.
Right. They got tax breaks for building, quote-unquote, green, which they were going to do anyway, and it was
going to
cost the state $900 million over 10 years.
And so she and another assemblywoman at the time, who was also in her second term, Debbie Smith, basically went in there and tried to roll it back. And Marilyn Kirkpatrick, she said that she felt like the lobbyists were treating her like she's stupid, but one thing that she is not, she's not stupid, but she also works extremely hard and sort of became the master of this policy and understood it well enough to push back against them and won a lot of respect. And, one thing that didn't make it into the profile is that she, and, there's this basically hard-working woman caucus, that they work extremely hard, they don't party a lot, which, you know, Patrick, you know, is part for many, part of the Carson City experience.
Experience.
Which is similar to the like Fremont experience.
Like the Fremont experience.
It's like an amusement park.
That's a canopy, though. And, you know, and these folks work their butt off to, you know, try to tackle policy in the state.
Right. Who else is in that caucus? Sheila Leslie would have been there. She was defeated.
Sheila Leslie, I guess Barbara Buckley, you know, they all sort of trace back to her as a mentor for many.
Former Speaker Barbara Buckley.
You know, if you want someone to watch next session, watch Irene Bustamante Adams. She's going to be the chair of taxation, assemblywoman, Democrat from Las Vegas. You know, hearing a lot of good things about her.
And she's the chair of the Hispanic caucus too, right? I think.
Yeah, she's active there. Yeah. I don't know if she's chair. I don't know.
I believe so. Well, anyways, go ahead.
So workhorses, not show horses, as we would say.
Exactly, and you know, there's always that sort of tension.
How will that shape? Will that shape the Democratic caucus?
I think it already has. I mean, Marilyn Kirkpatrick was not the favorite going into that vote. First of all, it was supposed to be Marcus Conklin, but he was defeated in the election in sort of this huge upset, given the amount of money that he spent, and sort of the heir apparent going into that closed door meeting. Among the lobbying class was William Horn, who's chair of the judiciary last session, but you know, Marilyn pulled it out.
Do we know why? She had some loyalty amongst...
She had some loyalty because, from what I understand, you know, she chaired two committees, worked them very hard, but also was willing to help along the
younger members
of the caucus.
And that paid off.
Yeah.
Tell us about Andrew Martin, recently elected Democratic Assemblyman. A judge had ruled that he did not live in his district. However, it was too late to take him off the ballot. And so now it appears, according to the statute, the legislature gets to decide his fate. Is there any news on that to begin with?
Well, I guess the news is that the judge on the eve of the election ruled from the bench, or said from the bench, I guess, you know, I don't think you live in the district. I'm ruling you're ineligible to run. But Andrew Martin ran anyway.
And he won.
Or won anyway, I should say.
In a heavily Democratic district.
Right. And Democrats, obviously, or Democrats control the assembly, and they have prudence over their own members, and they say, hey, we're going to seat them. Now, Andrew Martin hasn't wanted to talk about this very much. I saw him in the hallway during freshman orientation, and this pretty awkward conversation about him just saying he doesn't want to get into it, doesn't want to talk about it. He just wanted to say that he is an assemblyman, and he's looking forward to serving in the session.
Wouldn't this be a good first test for Speaker Kirkpatrick to say, I'm not going to put up with shenanigans like members who don't live in their own district, and no, we're not going to seat you, and we're going to have the Clark County Commission appoint another Democrat?
I guess it could, but, you know, I frankly don't know where Andrew Martin lives. I don't know if Marilyn Kirkpatrick does. It could also be seen as a test of, is she going to stand up for a member of her Democratic caucus? Look, some of the most excited people in the legislative bubble when Marilyn Kirkpatrick was picked were Assembly Republicans. They love Marilyn Kirkpatrick because she's not regarded as partisan. She's regarded as very fair and even-minded and caring just about policy in sort of this, I want to say, bordering on almost naive belief in good policy winning the day. So, you know, if she were to throw a member of her own caucus under the bus...
He's not even a member of the caucus, though. You know, like,
but they are, because they caucus right after the election,
members. I just mean in a kind of broader sense.
Right. It's a test. All I'm trying to say is that there's no easy answer.
No, I just don't know what there is to be. I don't know.
Point of view.
I'm not sure what there is to be gained by seating him. But anyway, that's we can talk about that more at a later date. Tell us about freshman orientation. You mentioned that. Were there some ice-breaking games? What goes on?
No beer pong. Mo Dennis told me that it's all about portion control when it comes to the snacking. They had little muffins. They got briefed on how much they make and their per diem and their expenses that they're allowed. And you had the leaders, or three out of the four of the leaders, up there talking. Marilyn Kirkpatrick was already scolding them to work harder even before the legislative session began. Uh-huh. You had Senator Dennis telling a very earnest story about two frogs fell into the cream and one gave up and drowned and the other one kept on kicking his webbed feet until he churned it into butter.
Okay.
Not
and then Pat Hickey,
one.
Come on, that's supposed to warm the cockles of your heart.
Yeah.
And then Pat Hickey said,
is that what you're giving to your young children now?
Pat Hickey tried to give a inspiring speech about working hard and moving past partisanship, and left with the immortal words of supposedly his uncle, who was a rancher, told him to keep your head down and your butt up and work hard. But I don't know, hard to get past the visual of that.
Yeah,
what he means.
I remember reading that. I thought I'm not familiar with that aphorism.
But it will be interesting. I mean, you got
so many
20%,
new ones, right? How many new?
You have 20%, I think 15 now, because one member, April Mastroluka, resigned suddenly. Or maybe 16. I don't know. It's over 20% that are freshmen.
Into two houses.
And basically now you have all
the
long
hair. Right?
What was that?
There are some new senators who had been in the assembly.
Right. You have some senators who had been in the assembly, but, you know, Mark Menendo is now the senior member of the legislature. He's had the most terms under his belt.
Exciting.
And so all the old hands are really gone at this point. This is the era of term limits that voters passed and put in the Constitution, and you have all these interesting dynamics of new leaders and all these freshmen who do want to assert themselves. You know, in the past, I think it's been be seen but not heard, and if you're seen, make sure your hands down and your ties on straight. And now I think you have this class that is going to want to make their mark from the get-go, and almost in a certain way has to, because they've got these short lifespans as lawmakers.
They need to start angling pretty quickly for leadership, and sometimes complicated legislation could take several sessions to pass, so they do need to get going right away.
Yep.
Let's talk about some big policy issues that are going to come up. You wrote over the weekend, I think, about the law that restricted foreclosures or forced bank officers to sign affidavits that could prove that they had a right to foreclose on a house. That, in turn, seemed to slow the foreclosures to a trickle, and the banks, and especially the realtors, who we should always be turning to for policy advice. I'm being facetious. They don't like it. They're going to come back at this issue. Tell us what's going on.
So they don't like it. They're going to come back. And look, lawmakers, even those who passed it, Marcus Conklin was one of the people who passed it, but the Attorney General, Catherine Cortez Masto, was also a major force behind this bill. And what they said was, we did not intend to stop legitimate foreclosures. We wanted to preserve the sanctity of the process, make sure banks had all their paperwork, basically push back against all the robo-signing that had been going on.
And people were losing their houses illegally in some cases.
Right.
Yeah.
But, and I can't help but think that at least underlying motive was somehow, look, we need to stop and take a breath and get a handle on this wave of foreclosures. They did not see it going, though, from 4,000, 5,000 a month to 80 when the law went into effect. Just this huge drop-off, and then you start seeing this problem of people living in their house, not paying their mortgage, and with no intent of paying their mortgage, but just living in their house, and the banks say they can't figure out how to get them out, or they couldn't get their
couldn't get their documents lined up to prove that they owned the house and could therefore foreclose on it.
Sure. Look, I understand. I have heard enough stories, and I don't think anyone is shedding gigantic tears for the banks, but from the more global perspective of the housing market, you know, having this shadow inventory out there creates this...
It's created a kink in the market.
Right. It's almost this, I don't want to say it's another bubble, but it's this artificial bump in housing prices that...
Due to lack of demand.
Your friends, the realtors, can now point to and say, oh, look, our housing market's turning around. Everything's great. We don't need, you know, larger policy discussions about forcing banks into principal reduction. We don't need these other things. The housing market is starting to turn around. When, if you look at the shadow inventory, a lot of folks I talk to who follow the real estate market say, look, the underlying... fundamentals aren't good right now.
So we do expect some action on this legislation?
I do. The Attorney General has formed a working group with the banks and realtors and consumer advocates to try to work on some compromise legislation. At a certain point, the banks were going to make a run and try to repeal this bill called AB 284 from last session. In the language in there, but now they've sort of moderated on it. So it'll be interesting how it plays out. But you also have a couple of pretty strong consumer folks in key positions in the legislature. You have Tick Siegerbloom, who's a attorney and one of the most vocal progressives in the legislature as chair of Senate Judiciary, who says, hey, I'm going to be very skeptical of anything that comes down. And you also have Jason Frierson, who's the assembly and the chair of the judiciary over in the assembly, who is seen as a up-and-comer and possible future leader. He's got a background in the public defender's office in Clark County.
All right, real quickly, Dave, we've only got about a minute here or less. Medicaid expansion paid for by the federal government under Obamacare. Will Sandoval go for it or not?
All signs are pointing to him going forward, yeah.
Okay.
I would be surprised if he wasn't.
Okay. Dave Schwartz, our man in Carson City. He's the Las Vegas Sun, a Carson City correspondent. He's getting ready for the legislature, which kicks off in February. Thanks so much for joining us, Dave.
You have been listening. Thank you both.
Thank you. You've been listening to KUNV 91.5 Neon Eden. My co-host, Tobin LePan. Our producer is Steven Zeller. I'm J. Patrick Hooligan. Catch you next week.